The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. So we're continuing on today with Chapter 2 from the special edition printed Oprah Daily Magazine, Let It Go. This is a special edition 2024 Live Your Best Life printed magazine, and it's how to de-stress, declutter, recharge, find your center, and finally relax. So the last show we based things on Chapter 1, so we're going to move on to Chapter 2. It's lighten your load, drag your thoughts away from your troubles by the ears, by the heels, or any other way, so you manage it. And that's a quote by Mark Twain. We're beginning with, what's your boiling point? Understanding your personal triggers is the first line of defense against stress. And this article is by Ronald Potter Efron, author of 10 books on anger management, most recently, Healing the Angry Brain. Most of us don't recognize the signs of stress until they've become too much to handle. But registering what each level feels like by building a stress meter can help you let off steam at a point well below she's ready to blow. Here's how. Plot your stressors. At each of the 7 levels in the meter at the right, write one word that describes your stress in increasing degrees of intensity. For instance, mild stress might leave you irked, disappointed, or dismayed, or perturbed. High stress, infuriated, attacked, or betrayed. With 0 representing complete calm, plot your words in order of rising stress. Over to the right, they have what looks almost like the thermostat that goes from blue all the way up to red at the top. To the left are lines for you to write your emotions here, and to the right are lines for you to write your physical response here. Next, think of an event from your past that sparked each emotion. A fight with your mother that left you frustrated, an email from a coworker that made you anxious, an argument with your partner that pushed you over the edge. What was your physical response in these situations? Were you pacing, sweating, clenching your jaw, muttering to yourself? Jot the relevant details across from each stress word. Then think back on all 7 of your stress scenarios and identify the point at which you felt yourself losing control. Now, go 2 levels below that. This is your new action point. When a stressful situation escalates to this level, you'll know you need to find a release. A calming effect. Your 3-step guide to finding peace. Number 1, escape. Remove yourself from the situation. If you're in the middle of a conversation, excuse yourself and spend a minute taking deep breaths in a quiet space. A bathroom break can be the perfect time out. If there's nowhere to run, say you're in a meeting, distance yourself with an eternal timeout. Picture yourself in a suit of armor with your stressors bouncing off you. It sounds silly, but it works. Number 2, seek solutions. Venting may feel good in the moment, but it only fuels tension. So when you call a friend to discuss frustrations rather than rehash things endlessly, tell her up front that you want advice on how to work through your stress. Try to focus your conversation on coming up with a problem-solving strategy, then move on. Number 3, find a release. A quick outburst like punching a pillow or shouting won't make a lasting impact on your stress. Instead, choose an activity with a defined beginning and end, such as a yoga class or a long hike. Think of it as an anecdote to your stressors and tell yourself, by the end of this, I will feel rejuvenated. The next article is Chaos Theory. Is your life ruled by clutter? Professional organizer and former flake, Julie Morgenstern, shares some hard-worn wisdom. From the day I was born until the birth of my own child, I was the classic right-brained creative type, living in a constant state of chaos. I lost everything you can possibly imagine. I lost little things, keys, umbrellas, wallets. I lost medium-sized things, the jacket to a vintage 1940s black suit. I lost big things, my roommate's car. I'd persuaded her to let me borrow it to meet a friend who had a 90-minute layover at O'Hare. I left late, drove maniacally, whizzed into the airport's parking garage, kicking myself for screwing up, and sprinted to the gate. By the time I arrived, I had only 5 minutes left to actually spend with my friend, four of which were taken up apologizing. As I slunk back to the garage, it dawned on me that I'd never stopped to notice the floor, section, or row where I'd parked. Armed with only a vague memory of the car as large and maroon, I spent four of the longest hours of my life walking in circles, utterly terrified to call my roommate. Finally, a security guard took pity and drove me around until I found it. Much easier now that it was almost midnight and the garage was nearly empty. I was a yo-yo organizer, spending marathon days clearing out the clutter only to have it return within the week. I live in the moment, never planning more than 30 seconds into the future. As a result, I was forever scrambling, unable to get things done on time, either because I couldn't find what I needed to make them happen, or because I'd forgotten they were due in the first place. I never got around to returning phone calls or balancing my checkbook, and the guilt of my overdue library books gnawed at me. Days would turn to weeks, then months, then years, till the fines became so formidable and the shame so great I thought I'd really reached the point of no return. But the truth is, no matter how disorganized I was, I always seemed to pull things off. Somehow I managed to arrive in the nick of time, produce high-quality work, please my teachers and my employers. I believed I was charmed, maybe even invincible. The public library came to my rescue with an amnesty program. My roommate's car was back in the driveway by the time she woke up. The day of reckoning came 3 weeks after my daughter was born. It was a crystal-clear afternoon in June, and I decided to take Jessie out for her first stroll by the waterfront. It occurred to me that I should take along a few supplies. What did I need? Let's see. Diapers, a blanket. Oh yes, a bottle. Maybe a toy or two. I started running around the house gathering baby stuff. I'd be all set, and then I'd think of something else. The snuggly, a sweater. By the time I was packed, it was 2.5 hours later, and Jessie had fallen asleep. I had missed the moment. I realized that if I didn't get my act together, my child was never going to see the light of day. In a fit of new determination, I dumped the contents of the bulging bag onto the floor. I grouped all the supplies into categories that made sense to me. Things related to feeding her, bottle, pacifier, things to keep her warm, blanket, booties, sweater, things to keep her dry, change of clothes, diapers, wipes, and things to entertain her, toys, music. I assigned each category a specific section of the bag so I could grab whatever I needed and know at once what was missing. Then I wrote an inventory of what belonged in the bag so I would never have to go through this again. Ba-boom! I had done it. For the first time in my life, I had successfully organized something. I felt powerful. I felt free. My child would never miss another opportunity because I wasn't ready. Being organized is all about being ready. ready for the phone to ring with a spur-of-the-moment invitation, ready for an emergency should a crisis erupt, ready to pursue your passions. Organizing is the process by which we create environment and schedules that enable us to live, work, and relax exactly as we want. It is a liberating process, an empowering, nurturing, exhilarating journey. And it's not about getting rid of things. Organizing from the inside out is a drive toward truth. It's about discovering the truth of who you are and what is important to you. Organizing is not the destination. It is the gateway to achieving your higher goals. To assess your current level of organization, ask yourself, can I find what I need when I need it? Does my environment allow me to express my whole self? Am I surrounded only by things I use and love? Is my day filled with the activities that are most important to me? If you answered yes to all these questions, relax, you're doing fine. But if you answered no, the next question is, are you ready for change? Surprisingly, the truth lies not in the quantity of piles or in how long you've been disorganized. Breakthrough occurs when you suddenly see something on the other side of the clutter that you desperately, vividly want. So let me give you an assignment. Ask yourself what is on the other side of your clutter. What do you hope to gain? Is it clear? Is it compelling? Are you ready to embrace it? Because the skills it takes to get organized are simple. Beyond the clutter, I promise you'll find the space and the time to fulfill your dreams. Create a saner to-do list. Pare down your daily list in a flash. Raise your hand if this sounds familiar. You've got your pad of paper and you're merrily scribbling down your to-dos. And when you get to about item number 10, panic sets in. How will you ever get everything done? You know perfectly well you won't, not until you devise a realistic plan. A manageable list will fuel your sense of accomplishment and allow you to get more done, says Julie Morgenstern, author of Never Check Email in the Morning. Given a list, office duties not included, that probably resembles the one buried at the bottom of your purse, Morgenstern revamped it her way. Follow her sensibly ruthless strategy, and your goals for any given day should fit on a scrap of paper no bigger than a Post-it. What your current list probably looks like. And there's a list of things, and there are little circles next to it, and some of them have checks in them, like they've been completed. Call Pamela. Kickboxing at the Y at 6. Organize vacation pics in online album. Cut it, unless it's going to bring you joy to sift through tons of blurry off-center images to find the gems, ask another family member to do it. Book flights to San Francisco. Help Aunt Linda assemble bookshelves. Reschedule coffee with Angela. Cut it. If this is a date you've been putting off, ask yourself, do I really want to hang out with Angela? Any plans that are tinged with guilt won't be on this list. And if it involves one of those friends who drain you because all they do is vent, just say no. Living room redo with 2? Remind Jackie not to forget Mom's birthday. Cut it. If Jackie is your sister and you know she's perfectly capable of remembering this on her own but chooses not to, don't make it your problem. It's not your job to compensate for other people's deficits. Check that last month's Amex bill was paid. Change it. A lot of the things that end up on our to-do lists are driven by worry. Looking for ways to out-automate tasks that seem to keep popping up will eliminate as much stress. In this case, sign up for automatic bill pay on your bank's website. Get groceries for dinner party. Cut it. The question we always ask ourselves is, how much can I do? But the smarter question is, how little can I do without cheating? When you've already overfooded, opt for a potluck. Learning to throw a party with minimal effort is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself. So your final list would look like this. call Pamela. Kickboxing at Y at 6. Help Aunt Linda assemble bookshelves. Living room redo. Sign up for automatic bill pay. Book flights to San Francisco. Insert energy here. For call Pamela. A good to-do list includes connecting with at least one friend. Maintaining relationships keeps you energized. Dodging them only increases your stress. Instead of setting yourself up to explain why it took you so long to call, dive right in and get caught up. For kickboxing, do something for yourself, especially something physical, every day. It doesn't have to be big or time-consuming to pay off in motive or happiness. For help Aunt Linda assemble bookshelves, promised favors can be a drag, but you should follow through. You'll feel better once it's done, and Aunt Linda will know she's important to you. For living room redo, have Pinterest-inspired dream of redecorating? Break a large-scale project into smaller, less intimidating tasks and put one on your list per week. Start by selecting a single significant element that can be changed, like the sofa. That will breathe new life into the room. Sign up for automatic bill pay. Once you register, you'll get an email from your bank when your payment is sent out, so you won't have to double-check or triple-check ever again. For book flights to San Francisco, never put off anything that could cost you money. Plus, once you have your flights booked, you start feeling the pre-vacation joy that comes with looking forward to a trip. And the last one on the list, insert emergency here. Many crises will come up. Hello, leaky bathroom faucet and surprise root canal. So leaving a time cushion to accommodate the unexpected will help keep your plan from suddenly going out the window. No snafus. More bonus time for you. Clear out your excuses. It's time to get rid of the reasons you can't declutter. You say, the thought of organization is too overwhelming. The truth is, you'd be surprised by what you can accomplish in 3 minutes, says Donna Smullin Cooper. And it's spelled S-M-A-L-L-I-N for the middle name, and the last name is K-U-P-E-R. Author of Clear the Clutter, Find Happiness. She suggests cleaning off the bathroom counter or emptying a shelf in the medicine cabinet while you draw a bath, or organizing a kitchen drawer while you wait for the popcorn to pop. Says Cooper, the little efforts you make ultimately add up. You say, but I'm a collector. The truth is, real collectors focus on, say, vintage lusterware, know the value of the items they have, and are always on the hunt for new pieces. What they don't do is stash them in a trash bag under the bed. A true collection, says Gail Stekete, and that's S-T-E-K-E-T-E-E, PhD and Dean of the Boston University School of Social Work and an expert on hoarding, is one that is kept in some sort of logical order and that you can show off. If you love your things, don't you want to see them? If you don't, toss them. You say, I'll need it someday. The truth is, if you have a heater or a pile of clothes you won't need until winter, try MakeSpace, a company that holds onto your stuff so you can avoid the hassle of renting a storage unit. Put in a request online for boxes, which will be delivered to your door, and MakeSpace will pick them up from anywhere in the continental United States. Plus, you'll receive an online photo catalog of the contents of each bin, so you'll never forget what you've stored. When you're ready, just log on and select the items you'd like to have sent back to you. You say, if I donate my computer, someone will steal my data. The truth is, your goal is simply to make access to your data difficult, that a criminal will look elsewhere, says Derek Meister, a social engagement and content strategist at Best Buy, which has recycled £1 billion of electronics. Before parting with your computer, check the owner's manual online for instructions on performing a factory reset, which will reformat the hard drive, blocking access to stored data. For added security, change the password on accounts you used with that device. This next section covers, breaking up is hard to do. Make decluttering agony-free with this handy cheat sheet. Keep if it's sentimental gold. The more memorabilia you have, the less emotionally valuable each individual item becomes, says Emily Wilska, an organization consultant in San Francisco. Instead of saving every card your beloved uncle ever sent, pick the one that captures his spirit best. Keep if it fits your life today. Your possessions should support who you are right now, not the person you were 5 years or 5 pounds ago. Your 10-year-old LBD that still looks great, it stays. Keep if you think it's gorgeous. Even if no one else does, stuff that makes you smile, like the glittery clothespin reindeer your child made in third grade, doesn't count as clutter. Keep if you'd buy it again. It's tough to be objective about your own belongings, so ask yourself, what would I do if I saw this in a store? Keep if you'll find a place for it. Putting it back in a box is just pre-disposal, says Aaron R. Doland, author of Unclutter Your Life in 1 Week. Any item worth keeping is worth creating a space for. Toss if you have twice as many as you need. Take inventory of your duplicate items. If you own enough spatulas and coffee mugs to supply a small diner, it's time to shed a few. Toss if it's a gift you don't love. Sometimes when we give away a present, we feel like we're giving away the person, says Elsa Jewett, a feng shui consultant based in Denver. Remind yourself that it's just an object. Toss if it's not worth repairing. Search for similar items on eBay. If your item's current value is less than the cost of repairing it, hello, broken printer from 2004, then toss and replace. Otherwise, give yourself a deadline. If you don't get around to fixing the thing within 6 months, you can probably let it go. Toss if your gut says lose it. Don't second-guess your instincts. A lot of people worry they'll have regrets, says life coach Gail Blank, author of Throw Out 50 Things. They're afraid that one day they'll need that exact thing, but 99% of the time, you just don't. Toss if you don't know what it is. UPOs, unidentified plastic objects, get 30 days. If there's still a mystery 1 month later, dump them. Next article is Put Time on Your Side. Like most American women, you're probably overscheduled and underrested, but with 3 easy strategies, you can add a few precious hours to your day. Number 1, this one saves 15 to 20 minutes. Handle things once. When it comes to email, voicemail, or paperwork, take instant action. For example, read, answer, delete, file, so you don't have to come back to it. The accumulated time saved can add up to 10 hours a month, says Jana Kemp, a Boise, Idaho time architect and the author of Know How One Simple Word Can Transform Your Life. Number 2, saves days. Cut TV time. You may think of TV as me time, but according to the American Time Use Survey by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2018, the average U.S. citizen watched 2 hours and 46 minutes of television a day. Reducing your television watching time by 5 hours a week adds up to 11 extra days a year, says Laura Stack, author of Find More Time. Number 3, saves your sanity. Turn off tech. Pinpoint the time of day when you are at your freshest and remove all distractions, says Los Angeles lifestyle coach Ruth Klein. For example, route all calls to voicemail and avoid your email inbox. You'll be much more productive. The 10-second attitude adjustment. There's an expression in neuroscience. Neurons that fire together wire together. This means that new patterns of thought can actually change the physiology of our brains. So while we can't ignore bad news, we can train our brains to become more alert to good information. When you notice a positive detail in yourself or someone else or in your environment, Try savoring it for at least 10 seconds. Most of these observations will be as simple as, the sun is shining, or this coffee tastes great. But do this a handful of times each day and you'll feel an emotional shift. Rick Hansen, PhD, neuropsychologist and co-author of Hardwiring Happiness. This next article is cloudy with a chance of rage. When writer Caitlin Moscatello found herself snapping at everyone and mad at the world, she went in search of a sunnier disposition. The miserable feeling started to creep in last spring. I was toughening up and not in a sexy, toned way. One particularly dreary morning, I snapped at an exhausted Starbucks barista. Does it really take 10 minutes to make a latte? Another night, when two tourists stopped on the subway steps in front of me, I pushed past them in a huff, hissing, "Move!" under my breath, as if the stairs were mine, as if I had laid them with my bare hands. A week later, when I found myself fuming at a doorman because he was following building policy by asking for my ID, I realized who I'd become, the crazy angry lady. Day after day, I was irrationally furious, and when I wasn't feeling bad about myself for being so unpleasant, I was getting mad about the next thing. My back started to hurt, and then my head. Eventually, I had a dull ache all over. Therapists told me I wasn't depressed. Doctors told me I was physically healthy. I went to an acupuncturist. I took ibuprofen, but I couldn't shake the feeling. Anger is one of the most basic human emotions, and according to some experts, more and more women are seeking help to contain it. One Rachel McDavid, a licensed marriage and family therapist in New York City, started running anger management workshops in 2007. It was mostly men, she says. But over the past few years, I've had several workshops that were almost completely filled with women. The uptick is due to part to a cultural shift that's made it more acceptable for women to display negative emotions. While women are still socialized to suppress anger, we now have some powerful female role models who aren't sweet and happy all the time, and who show that it's okay to be assertive and express frustration, says Stacy M. Rosenfeld, PhD, a licensed clinical psychologist in Florida. But there's also been a sharp rise in just how stressed women are. According to a survey by the American Psychological Association, 43% of women felt their stress levels had increased over the past 5 years, and about 39% reported experiencing irritability or anger as a symptom of stress. Women are juggling so many different roles in so many different settings, says Mary Alvord, PhD, a psychologist and adjunct associate professor at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. That's not new. Women have been doing this balancing act for decades. But these days, the expectations that you're leaning in, plugged in, chipping in, are higher, while our network of support is smaller. It used to be that you had family and friends nearby, but that tribe is shrinking because people are either just as busy as you are or too far away to help. And when you consider that married moms with children under 18 are now the primary breadwinner in 15% of households, up from just 4% in 1960, that daughters are more than twice as likely as sons to care for aging parents, and that mothers still do nearly double the child care and housework dads do, it's not surprising that many women are nearing the end of one very frayed rope. When I asked my friends whether stress was making them angrier, they laughed and chimed in with stories of free-floating rage. One friend said she blew up a cab driver who got lost when she was late for a meeting. I didn't even give the guy a tip, she says now with a twinge of guilt. Another recalled how bad she felt after shouting at her cubicle mate for playing his music too loud. It was clear that this feeling, we jokingly called it Angry Woman Syndrome, AWS, have gotten under our skin. And according to at least one study, AWS might actually be contagious. Researchers at China's Belhang University recently discovered that anger is the fastest spreading emotion on one social media network in the country. People were much more likely to repeat or comment on things that made their blood boil than on those that conveyed joy. One reason for this may be our misguided belief that lashing out will purge us of negative emotions. In fact, it can just make the anger wheel spin faster. When people become angry, the natural response is to do something aggressive, punch something, kick something, say something mean, says Brad Bushman, PhD professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. And after venting, about 75% of people say they feel better. But what they don't realize is that the good feeling is fleeting and reinforces the destructive behavior. Staying in this mad-at-the-world spiral can do more than just alienate coworkers, friends, and innocent strangers. When you feel you've just had it, your blood pressure shoots up, triggering the body's fight-or-flight response, and in turn activating hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. And when these hormones are chronically flooding your system, they can do nasty things to your health. Weaken your immune response, trigger chronic headaches, cause inflammation. Researchers have even found that people who can't control their anger heal from wounds more slowly than their mellower counterparts. So, fine, getting mad isn't the answer. But I wasn't having much success curing my AWS with relaxation techniques like walking it off or taking 10 deep breaths. Turns out, though, that such remedies do work. I was just going about them wrong. According to anger management specialist Ronald Potter, EFRON, PhD, author of Healing the Angry Brain, people assume they're calm after 30 seconds of deep breathing, he says. But our bodies don't recover that quickly. Most people need at least 20 minutes to an hour to truly let the emotion pass. And as long as we're still amped up, it's easy to re-trigger the anger that's just beneath the surface. The solution is to use your cool-down time to figure out exactly what's at the root of your annoyance. In many cases, people can fairly quickly pinpoint the real issue if given time to think it through clearly, says Potter Efron. Of course, I wanted solutions to pull myself out of an irritable rut, but I also wanted to learn how to avoid that rut in the first place. Neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, PhD, author of Hardwiring Happiness, believes that we can retrain our brains to focus on the positive and prevent feelings of rage from taking hold. This doesn't mean thinking about glitter and sunshine when you'd rather slam the bathroom door. It's about consistently paying attention to what makes you feel good and then spending time actually doing it. The goal is to shore up reserves for when things go off track. Not unlike the logic of getting a flu shot. You want your defenses up before the bug hits. To inoculate against AWS, Hansen suggests taking note of as many small, happy moments as you can throughout the day and stopping to enjoy them. Researchers have found that people who regularly practice mindfulness tend to have more neural connections in the regions of the brain associated with self-awareness, making them less likely to react negatively to frustrating situations, Hansen says. I knew my madness had to stop. Step one was buying a pair of sneakers and dragging my cranky self outside for a run. From there, I inched my way forward, making a point to reconnect with friends I'd seen that had been too busy to meet up with, doing little things for myself, like buying a bottle of my favorite lotion and cooking more often. Don't get me wrong, I still catch myself mid-eye roll when someone sits directly in front of me in yoga class. It's called staggering, girlfriend. And last week, when I was grocery shopping, a guy banged his basket right into my elbow and kept walking. I wanted to stomp up to him and say, excuse you. Instead, I reminded myself that a plastic basket isn't an assault weapon and focused on the delicious stuffed squash I was planning to make. Sure, he'd thrown the first, most likely innocent jab, but I've learned to stop jabbing back. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Our next article is Make the World Go Away. Can floating in a sensory deprivation chamber relieve stress? Writer Lindsay Funston takes the plunge. I don't suffer from claustrophobia. I've never had that nightmare about being buried alive. But when I see the Restricted Environmental Stimulation Therapy, REST, tank at a wellness center in New York City, bright blue and egg-shaped like something out of Avatar, I feel a twinge of doubt. I'm going to be in that for an hour? The REST tank is an 8-foot-long pod filled with 10 inches of water that is kept close to skin temperature at 95.7 degrees. It contains 1,200 pounds of Epsom salt for buoyancy, and inside it's pitch black and dead silent. This is the 21st century version of the sensory deprivation tank, invented by neuroscientist John C. Lilly in the 1950s to explore how greatly reducing the sensations of sight, sound, and gravity affects consciousness. Over the years, people found the tanks calming. Indeed, proponents of REST claim that floating leads the brain to generate more theta waves, prevalent in light stages of sleep, and induce a state of relaxation we usually achieve only in deep meditation. Today, floating is on the rise as an alternative to meditation. My brain is always in overdrive, so I'm eager for a radical downshift. I shower, pop in earplugs, and, still naked, step into the tank. The water feels surprisingly chilly as I slosh in the front of the open pod, my feet dragging against the salt's weight. I sit down, then lie back, and just like that, I could be floating in the Dead Sea. I push one interior button to lower the top, and another to turn off the light. Here we go. Just breathe. Yeah, right. Trying to zone out in the darkness without my iPhone to distract me is tougher than I'd imagined. All my thoughts just have more room to ramble. I forgot to text Mom. What's for dinner? Is there a hidden camera in here? I try to deeply inhale and exhale for 10 minutes or so, though I've lost all sense of time, and then realize I can no longer even feel the water. Whoa, this is a real trip. Next thing I know, my right arm is jerking, jolting me back to consciousness. Did I reach Theta? Before I have time to contemplate this or fret that the staff has forgotten about me, the faint sound of crashing waves fills the pod, signaling the end of my session. I can't believe an hour has passed. After I rinse away the flecks of salt in the shower, I find I'm clear-headed but also relaxed. In fact, sedated. Back at the office, I can't help reclining in my chair. My coworkers have to ask me to speak louder. That night, I fall into a magically deep sleep. The magnesium from the salt, I've read, has a relaxing effect on the body. My chillax buzz lasts nearly a week. Tight deadlines at work don't feel paralyzing. I don't huff over subway delays. Avid floaters treat tank time like regular massages, unwinding in the pod every month. I'm not ready to take it that far, but next time I'm in sensory overload, I'm going to draw a warm bath, grab my eye mask and earplugs, and try floating my cares away. This next article is Take the Stress Out of Decision-Making, a no-dithering guide to weighing your options, by Catherine Price. Number 1. Identify your goal. As David Welch, PhD professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and author of Decisions, Decision, The Art of Effective Decision-Making, explains, people aren't self-reflective, are going to end up making bad decisions because they don't really know what they want in the first place. Before you switch jobs, ask yourself, do I really want a different career or do I just want a different boss? Don't make a decision based on the wrong problem. Number 2, consider what you really want. If you're trying to buy a digital camera or looking to upgrade your smartphone, list the features you'll actually use. Any camera that has them is therefore good enough for you. Ignore anything fancier. Number 3, be aware of biases. They can lead smart people to make dumb decisions. For example, we hate to lose more than we like to win, which can result in behaviors such as holding on to a tanking stock instead of accepting a loss. We remember vivid examples better than facts, which is why plane crashes stick in our heads more than statistics on air safety. And we're susceptible to how information is framed. A cash discount is more appealing than a no credit card surcharge. Number 4, try not to rush. People tend to make poorer choices when they're in a bad mood or under a lot of stress. When facing a complex decision, use your conscious brain to gather the information you need and then take a break. Go for a walk, spend a half hour meditating, take a nap, have a beer. The idea is to give your conscious mind some time to do its work. The decision you make afterward is more likely to be the right or at least a perfectly acceptable one. Number 5, don't sweat the small stuff. When possible, eliminate the need for decisions by establishing rules for yourself. You will go to yoga every weekend. You will not have more than 2 glasses of wine. You will buy whatever toilet paper is on sale. Number 6, do a post-game analysis. After each decision you make, ask yourself how you felt afterward and what you learned from the experience. How can you apply these lessons in the future? This article is Hang Loose. You might think worrying, maintaining tight control, and resisting change will forestall disaster. Actually, says life coach Martha Beck, it only drives you nuts. No offense, but you were probably born a bit clenched. Most of us were. Anyone who's ever cared for a distressed newborn has witnessed impressive levels of clenching fists, face, tummy, legs. The one thing babies can do when confronted with pain or fear is scrunch up tight. And let's be honest, we're all just babies with a few miles on the odometer. I sometimes wonder whether we're so haunted by the trauma of birth that unclenching never occurs to us. There I was. Our proverbial minds recall floating contentedly, trusting absolutely, fearing nothing, and then bam! Bright lights, cold air, and years of diapers. Decades later, we're still lurching around with coiled fists, braced for the worst. The irony is that the best way to deal with distress is to relax. Literally, relax, or loosen again. There's a wonderful German word, Losgelassenheit, that describes the motion of a horse when it relaxes and trusts its rider so absolutely that their movement becomes a joyful, fluid dance. We can clench our way through an adequate life, but only Losgelassenheit produces greatness. Living fully requires a return to the looseness that predates our first breath, to an untroubled trust that we are supported by a universe that has no interest in hurting us, only in teaching us to dance. My preferred way of coaching clients and myself through this process is to first try relaxing in specific limited ways and then checking to see whether disaster follows. If it does, we can always reclench. But if nothing terrible occurs, we may find the courage to unwind a little more and then a little more, all the way into Losgelassenheit. Here's my loosening up to-do list. Number 1, relax your need to relax. Long ago at my daughter's gymnastics meet, I heard the mother of another 6-year-old hiss into her child's ear, "Danielle, would you at least try to relax?" I doubt poor Danielle had a moment's relaxation before or since, no matter how hard she tried. The problem with trying to relax, of course, is that it's paradoxical. The moment you start trying, you're not relaxing. To deal with this conundrum, start by loosening your need to loosen. Right now, notice the level of tension in your body. See if your breathing is contracted, your facial muscles tight, your stomach churning. Next, check your mental state. Are you perfectly calm and peaceful or plagued by fear or stress? Whatever you discover, take a deep breath and don't relax at all. Tell yourself that it's all right to be exactly as tense as you are. Just feel whatever you're feeling. There, isn't that a relief? Number 2, relax your attention. Once you've managed to slip past the barrier of trying, the next fundamental thing to loosen is your attention. This is the opposite of what you were taught as a child. When adults told you to concentrate on only one thing, a teacher, a dull-as-dirt schoolbook, while ignoring everything else. But researchers have discovered that this kind of tight focus can actively prevent relaxation. So throw out that idea. Instead, look straight ahead and find something to be the center of your visual field. A flower, a candle flame, a spot on the wall. Then, without moving your eyes from the target, widen the focus of your attention so that it includes everything in your visual field, from the center to the outside edges. Think of the target as important and everything else as unimportant. Then, and here's where things likely veer from your usual practice, make all of it, everything you see, equally important, top to bottom, left to right, all just as essential. Did you try it? If so, you may have noticed that as your attention opened, so did your mind and body. Maybe your muscles became softer, more elastic. Maybe you forgot to worry. Maybe you can't even remember what happened because, for a moment, you weren't thinking. Contrary to conventional wisdom, this soft, unconcerned, no thought is the sensation of being alert and perceptive. Try relaxing your focus in a variety of situations, while cooking or cleaning, perhaps. Number 3, relaxed into whatever's happening. 19th century journalist Margaret Fuller once famously proclaimed, "I accept the universe," to which essayist Thomas Carlyle replied, "Gad, she'd better." Tom had a solid point. Struggling against reality is exhausting, nonstop labor with profoundly disappointing results. I've worked with innumerable clients who were perpetually in full flight from the simple facts of their lives. If you're like them, try relaxing into whatever's already happening. You may as well, right? Whatever exists at this moment is beyond your control. So right now, and a minute from now, and an hour from now, and so on, let it be. For the time it takes you to read the rest of this column, stop trying to change things. Feel how much energy fills that loosened space. Number 4, relax the standards you can never meet. One reason many of us resist our current situation is that it fails to match our own expectations. This isn't right, we think. I'm not supposed to be a divorced, anxious, aging office manager with wine stains on her blouse. I'm supposed to be a wealthy paragon of spiritually advanced yet smolderingly desirable perfection. Ha ha. For whatever reason, media images, standardized testing, our parents, a combination of the above, almost all our cherished standards of excellence are goals we can't achieve, much less sustain. Strive for the trappings of happiness is taking you further and further from actual happiness. Observe a roomful of your relatives, a dozen people you pass on the street, the folks currently wandering around the mall food court. How many of them do you think match the standards you wish you could attain? I thought so. Now try relaxing your standards to the point where all these people are good enough to exist, feel, deserve compassion. Imagine setting your standards so low that every being you meet is good enough. If you did this for yourself, would your life go straight to hell? Maybe. Or maybe, who knows, your world might start to feel a bit more like heaven. Number 5, relax your resistance to uncertainty. If I knew you'd already tried the little experiments above, I'd be very pleased. If I knew you were going to try them again tomorrow and the next day and the next, I'd be astonished. Most people who ask me for advice, and mind you, they're paying for it, seem to consider it an object for contemplation, never actually a tool to be used. I think that's because doing anything unfamiliar forces us to confront life's inherent uncertainty. And that's especially true for relaxing, with its implied relinquishment of control. When faced with what we don't know, we go the Hamlet route, deciding we would rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. If we just clench up tightly enough, says the birth-rattled infant within us, nothing unexpected or unpleasant will ever happen again. Of course, this only blinds us to life's opportunities and adventures. If we'd never left the womb, we'd never have experienced the world. As spiritual writer Mark Nepo says, we are the only creatures that seek out guarantees, and in so doing, we snuff the spark that is discovery. Relaxing our need to be certain, our illusion that we're in control, is the only way to regain that spark. So try the relaxation ideas I've already described, and then, when you are a bit less tightly clasped than usual, take 5 minutes to sit in a quiet place. With every exhale, mentally repeat, "Now I am dying." With every inhale, think, "Now I am being born." Both statements are true. With every passing instant, the present you disappears into the past, and a new you steps into the world. For 5 minutes, feel this. Die and be born. Die and be born. Die and be born. Get used to it. When you can relax into death and rebirth, you can handle anything. Each moment is a chance to be reborn, this time without clenching and tightening. But that isn't a goal, and it isn't a virtue. If we think of it that way, we'll never relax. Re-loosening is simply a way to feel better, right now, for its own sake. Once we stop exerting intense effort, choosing instead to soften our attention, accept whatever's happening, loosen our judgmental standards, and allow life to flow along its uncertain path, our experience of life gradually re-loosens, going from frightening and painful to interesting. The powers that shape us turn out to be not punishing, condemnatory monsters, but forces that teach us Losgelassenheit, showing us how joyful, graceful, and delightful life can be. Parts of this article were edited due to time. So that ends Chapter 2 from the printed Let It Go Oprah Daily magazine. Heading back over to the digital Oprah Daily, we're going to take a look at Oprah Insider, Oprah on Jealousy and Envy. In all my years on the Oprah Winfrey Show, I saw all too often the havoc that these emotions can wreak on friendships and romantic relationships, and also on family dynamics. And this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Hey everybody, I'm back from vacay, feeling recharged, and I hope you're having a lovely, peaceful Sunday. Recently, Gail and I did a sit-down with Melinda Gates talking about our friendship. You can find that full interview on YouTube. But the clip that got the most response was me talking about friends who are jealous and how it is just impossible to have a meaningful relationship if there's even the slightest, teeniest, tiniest kind of envy or jealousy. And last week, I touched on one of the things that has made Gail and my friendship so strong. I said that whenever I have a success, she's always been happier for me than I am for myself. And I like to think that I pay that back to her, too. Although nobody can out-happy Gail, on a baseline happiness scale of 1 to 10, she's a 14. Anyhow, I wanted to note that we tend to interchange the words envy and jealousy, but there is a clear-cut difference. Years ago, when I first interviewed Brené Brown, she spelled it out in a way that really clicked for me. She said, envy is when we want something that somebody else has. Jealousy is when we are afraid of losing something we already have to someone else. Now, there's a piece on our site this week that delves a little deeper into this difference. In all my years on the Oprah Winfrey Show, I saw all too often the havoc that these emotions can wreak on friendships and romantic relationships, and also on family dynamics. Envy and jealousy are straight-up happiness destroyers. So this week I ask you, is there a time you've let jealousy or envy get the better of you? Or when someone was jealous or envious of you, what did you do? Or what would you do differently if you could live that again? Let me know in the comments below. You know how much I love hearing from you. Have a blessed week and go well. Parts of this article were edited due to time. And there's a comment from Bill2719. I listened to this in the morning and have been pondering my response. During our working lives, I was envious. My husband and I worked very hard but saw little financial gain. We're both frugal, so it wasn't an issue of overspending. It seemed like others didn't have to put in the effort as much as we did, and they appeared to be living the good life. Trips, toys, etc. Now that we're retired, I see through a different lens. Our kids are doing well, and they attribute their work ethic to us. Now I concentrate on gratitude for what we have and not comparing our lives to others. Here's another comment from NOHEMY7203. I'm not proud to say that both of these have got the best of me, but after hearing Oprah's message, I recognize it was almost always in my lowest points. One of those was when I had a series of unsuccessful pregnancies. I couldn't bear to see friends posting or sharing their experiences. In group therapy, I found that I was not the only one. It certainly comes from a place of unhappiness, and it felt terrible. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.